On August 23rd, federal court judge Royce Lamberth stunned scientists nationwide when he issued a temporary injunction against President Obama's 2009 executive order lifting restrictions on embryonic stem cell research. Within weeks, a federal appeals court placed a temporary stay on the Lamberth ruling while it considered the case. Regardless of the outcome of this legal fight, it's renewed the contentious debate over the use of human embryos in biomedical research. University of Minnesota is home to the world's first interdisciplinary institute dedicated to stem cell research and currently has millions of dollars in federal research grants that could be affected by the court's decision. Its director, Jonathan Slack, has been widely quoted in the local media regarding this case, and tonight he's here to help us understand this timely and very complicated issue. Dr. Slack was named director of the University Stem Cell Institute in 2007. A native of England, he earned a degree in biochemistry from Oxford and a PhD in molecular biology from Edinburgh University. His scientific curiosity led him to the rarefied field of developmental biology, where in 1986 he was the first researcher to identify a growth factor in the frog embryo, a breakthrough discovery that was later shown to apply to all vertebrate embryos. His research now focuses on reprogramming cells in the hopes of finding future treatments for diabetes. Prior to coming to the University of Minnesota, he worked as a staff scientist for nearly 20 years at the Imperial Cancer Research Fund in London and served as head of the Department of Biology and Biochemistry at the University of Bath. In 2002, he was awarded the Waddington Medal of the British Society for Developmental Biology. In addition to more than 150 articles published in scientific journals, he is the author of three books, including the seminal textbook, Essential Developmental Biology. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jonathan Slack.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Mary, and welcome to everybody this evening. Actually, I came along to talk about a bit more than just the Lamberth injunction, so I hope you won't want to just hear about that, although I'm very happy to discuss the implications of that when we get to the questions. But my topic is very broad, actually. It's stem cells and regenerative medicine. So what's it all about? Let's see if this works. Yeah, here we are. Now, what we would like to think it was about is, oh yes, we've got two screens, haven't we? In which case my point is going to be a bit misleading. Well, I'll try not to use it too much. So anyway, this is what everybody wants. This is an old painting, but it indicates the, you get the idea, the old and decrepit and sick and suffering are wheeled up on the left side in their carriages. They jump into the revitalizing fountain of youth, and they make their way across it, and then they're young and glossy again and ready to go. So that's what we all want. And the reason we want it, actually we want it even more than we did in 1546, because in those days, of course, most people died really quite young in those days, and most people of infectious diseases, whereas now, at least in the richer parts of the world, and, you know, the whole of the world is becoming rich quite rapidly now, so we can very soon say in the whole world, health needs are very, very different from hundreds of years ago. Nowadays, most people die of degenerative diseases of one sort or another, such as the very common diseases listed on the screen here. And, you know, quite commonly, for some period before death, people suffer a lot from these conditions. And if you think about it, all of these conditions are ones in which, well, with the possible exception of cancer, although even there I think cell replacement may be important, in all the other cases, some cell population or other has gone bad, stopped working, died, and in principle, cell replacement could benefit just about all of these conditions. And while we're never going to be able to live forever, they might at least prolong the period of active and healthy life as long as possible. So what's regenerative medicine and how does it differ from stem cell research? It doesn't differ very much, really, but the way I understand regenerative medicine is it's a bit broader. So it covers things like gene therapy, where instead of putting in new cells, you're putting in new genes, and it would cover things like stimulation of regeneration, stimulation of endogenous processes of regeneration, or perhaps also the tissue engineering, as people call it, so bolting together artificial organs in vitro, in tissue culture situations, before grafting them. So it's a bit broader than stem cell research, but very often people use the term regenerative medicine when they don't like to use the term stem cells in public. There's a certain rather well-known clinic, which I shan't name, in Minnesota, a bit to the south of here, which takes this view. And so sometimes it's just a matter of terminology. Okay, so what is a stem cell? And in essence, this is what a stem cell is. It has to have two properties. It's a type of cell which can renew itself by cell division and can also generate differentiated functional cell types. And, well, this is just a diagram from one of my books, and it's rather figurative, but it could represent the stem cells in just about any of the tissues of your body that have stem cells. Not all tissues do have stem cells, but a certain number do. And it also applies to embryonic stem cells. So these are the two critical features: self-renewal and the ability to generate functional differentiated progeny cells. And very crudely, there are these two sorts of stem cell: embryonic stem cells, about which all the political and ethical fuss is about, and so-called adult stem cells. Adults in inverted commas, because I've always felt a bit uncomfortable about this designation of adult. And one of the things I'd like to convey to you, you can't convey masses of complex science, but one basic idea I'd like to get across is that what people call adult stem cells are not cells like embryonic stem cells that just happen to come from the adult. Adult stem cells are quite different. They are specialized cells that are responsible for the renewal of individual tissue types. And, of course, they're not only found in adults. They're found in late embryos and in children or young animals and people, as well as adults. So here are the embryonic stem cells, and on the left is a human embryo, and it's at about 5-6 days maybe of development. It's got maybe 60 or 70 cells in it. It's a ball of cells, all of which are destined to become part of the placenta, and a little clump of cells in here, many of which also are destined to become part of the placenta, and some of which will contribute some offspring to the fetus. Now, if you take those cells, that little mass that's called the inner cell mass, and put it in a tissue culture dish and give it the correct nutrient media, you can grow embryonic stem cells, which are thought to be quite similar in their intrinsic state to the inner cell mass cells that used to be in the embryo, but they're not quite the same. Their gene expression patterns are a bit different. And this is what embryonic stem cells look like. Each of these green blobs is actually a colony of cells. So I can't quite... This one might have about 10 to 20 cells in. This one might have 50 or 100 cells in. They're green because these are actually mouse ES cells, not human, and they have a green gene put into them. And there's all this gray stuff in between the colonies of embryonic stem cells are what we call feeder cells. And those are fibroblasts, which are the sort of cell that you get when you explant almost any adult tissue and put it into tissue culture. And they've been irradiated to stop them dividing. But they're needed to keep the embryonic stem cells happy because they secrete a number of substances that the embryonic stem cells like and need in order to keep growing and in fact to prevent them from differentiating. Because in this state, they're growing but not differentiating. So that's what embryonic stem cells look like. Adult stem cells, as I said, are really the normal precursors to each tissue type. And there's a few pictures here. I think, slightly fanciful pictures. These the blood-forming stem cells, or hematopoietic stem cells, as scientists like to call them, normally live in the bone marrow, and this picture shows them sitting on the osteoblasts, or bone-forming cells, which is supposed to be where they live. Probably not every one of these little blobs is a hematopoietic stem cell, because they're few and far between in the bone marrow. But I'll come on to say a bit more about them in a minute. The intestine is a place where cells are being renewed all the time. There are stem cells at the base of the crypts in the intestine. So this is our section, and each of the little blue blobs is a cell, and the intestine is lined with these little finger-like processes called villi, which gives it a big, big area so it can absorb the food. And in between the villi, there are... Actually, I can't really see the slide. I don't know whether you can see it. But in between the villi, there are these little pits full of cells called crypts, and that's where the stem cells live. And they're dividing all the time, and their progeny are moving out onto the surface of the villi, doing their job concerned with absorption and digestion of the food for maybe 2 or 3 days, and then dying and falling off into the gut cavity. And then there are actually not very many stem cells in the brain, but I wouldn't like to say that these green cells are absolutely guaranteed to be stem cells, but there are actually, even in human beings, at least 2 regions of the brain where there is some cell renewal, and there are some stem cells. Those are the lining of the lateral ventricles of the brain, which generate olfactory neurons, and a region called the hippocampus that generates neurons involved in sort of complicated things like memory. So there is a bit of cell renewal in the brain, but actually the main cerebral cortex, which is where we do most of our thinking, there's probably no renewal of neurons there. And, well, in order to treat that list of diseases I presented in the first slide, in essence, each type of disease, you could imagine that you might be able to fix it or improve it with a graft, a suitable graft to a suitable place of a suitable cell type. I'm going to say a little bit more about... pancreatic islets later on. I'm not going to say anything much about heart muscle because I don't really think it's going to be quite a long time before there's any real stem cell therapy of the heart in terms of replacing damaged heart muscle. But that is obviously one important objective. And I'm also not today going to say anything about treating neurodegenerative diseases, although I understand people may want to ask about that. So if you want these cells, how do you get them? And this slide really refers mostly to embryonic stem cells, which are capable of making... I think we've missed a slide, actually. I've got a feeling. See, I can't really see them very well. No, we haven't missed one. Anyway, embryonic stem cells, at least in principle, are capable of making just about any of the cell types in the body. And this is why they're regarded as so important, because you can grow them without limit in culture, and they can, at least in theory, make any cell type in the body that you might want. The adult stem cells, because they are precursors of individual tissue types, on the whole, can only make the cell type of the tissue they come from. And also, in most cases, it's very difficult to culture adult stem cells and expand them in vitro, although that there are a few cases where you can, but in general, it's difficult. So how do you persuade, in particular, embryonic stem cells to make the sort of cell you want? Well, there's 2 ways, 2 general strategies. Overwhelmingly, the most important for the sort of clinical trials that may happen in the next few years is what we usually call gardening. And that means growing the cells and treating them with substances in order to coax them through a series of developmental decisions. And the gardening is actually a little bit more rational than everyday gardening in your backyard, although not completely rational. And it's based on the science I've been involved in for the last 35 years, which is the study of normal embryonic development. So, for example, if you want a pancreatic beta cell for treatment of diabetes, the development of the pancreas has been studied very thoroughly by, you know, hundreds of labs in the last 20 years or so, and we know a lot about how it normally develops. And we know that between the fertilized egg and a functioning insulin-producing beta cell, you've got to go through about 5 steps of developmental decisions, 5 processes where the cells see some chemical signal and make an appropriate response to it. So you need, in effect, 5 different chemical signals delivered at the right concentration, in the right way, at the right time. But many or most of those chemical signals are known from study of normal development. So this process of gardening can be carried out to some extent rationally. And the other possibility, some of these things really don't work very well. Some of the cell types are very difficult to get, even from embryonic stem cells. And so some people think it will be necessary actually to drive the development by putting in genes. It's also thought that the Food and Drug Administration are not going to like this, and that it's going to be very difficult to get approval to give any cell that's got any genes in it to patients. So, some scientists think this is important. People who want FDA approval in the next couple of years want to steer clear of it. Yeah, so that's the slide that should have been a bit earlier. So embryonic stem cells can produce any cell type. Adult stem cells normally can produce only their own tissue type. And I just want to say a little bit about adult stem cells, if only to get across the idea that actually stem cell therapy has been going on for a long time. And most people have heard of it under the name bone marrow transplantation. And if you transplant bone marrow, what you're really transplanting are these things, where you're transplanting a whole load of cells, but the cells that matter are these ones, called hematopoietic stem cells, or blood-forming stem cells. And they live in the bone marrow, and they normally make all of the cells of the blood, the red cells, the lymphocytes, the macrophages, all the blood cell types, and all the cell types of the immune system, which are not just the circulating lymphocytes, but also various cell types anchored in tissues and responsible for all sorts of immune phenomena. So there's quite a variety of cell types are being produced every day of our lives in the bone marrow by these hematopoietic stem cells. And I'm pleased to say, for those who don't know already, that the University of Minnesota has always been very big in bone marrow transplantation, or hematopoietic cell transplantation. And this guy, Robert Good, in 1968, did the first successful bone marrow transplant. And this was actually for somebody with an immune deficiency disease. It wasn't for cancer. And it was a graft from a sibling, an older sibling. And I believe the patient is still alive and well in Minnesota today. There had been previous bone marrow transplants in other centers in the previous 20 years or so, but all of the patients had died. So this was the first successful one. And the U has remained a leading center for hematopoietic transplantation since then. In more recent years, the umbilical cord blood has joined the bone marrow as an important source of blood-forming stem cells, and there's a lot of cord blood transplants done nowadays. And mostly bone marrow transplantation is used for the treatment of cancer. And the original rationale, well, in fact, mostly for the treatment of lymphomas and leukemias. And the original rationale was that if you can give enough radiation or enough chemotherapy to kill every single cancer cell in the body, then you've cured the patient. But if you give that much treatment, you inevitably kill off all of the patient's own hematopoietic stem cells, and the patient will die from bone marrow failure. So if you can graft in some good bone marrow, maybe the patient can be revived. And that was the original rationale, and it's a perfectly correct rationale. And It's, I think, something like, is it 50,000 people have had bone marrow transplants or cord blood transplants around the world in the last 20 or 30 years, and it is a life-saving and successful technique. It's always evolving. People are constantly devising new applications and new variations on treatments. And in particular, I know that it's not my area of work, but I know that in recent years, the rationale to some extent has shifted, and now people feel it's actually the immune reaction of the graft against the tumour is just as important as the sort of blood repopulating effect. But don't ask me too detailed questions about that, because it's a very complicated area which I don't understand very well. But I think even more interesting is the fact that the hematopoietic blood-forming stem cell-type grafts are not only used for the treatment of cancer. In fact, as I said, the first one done in Minnesota was for the treatment of a blood disease, an inherited immune deficiency. So, in principle, any genetic blood disease could be corrected by a bone marrow transplantation if you exchange the entire blood-forming system. But there seem to be other possibilities as well. And two of our own faculty have actually only just, talk about headlines, this is a nice headline, not the nasty headlines like the Judge Lamberth's injunction, but a very nice headline in the New England Journal of Medicine this August was a paper from John Wagner and Jakub Tolar and Bruce Blazer from our medical school. And they've devised this really remarkable method of treating a genetic skin disease with bone marrow or cord blood transplantation. And here you might think, well, where's the rationale in that? You know, the bone marrow graft may replace the blood, but this particular type of skin disease called epidermolysis bullosa is an inherited disease in which one of the proteins that glues down the outer layer of the skin, the epidermis, is missing. And the unfortunate babies just lose all their skin. It just all falls off, and they, without treatment, would die pretty quickly. And it seems that the grafts, they don't regenerate the skin, but they do produce cells all over the body, including various specialized cells and immune cells. Some of those cells lodge in the skin, and they seem to produce enough of the collagen 7, the missing protein, to cure the disease, or at least improve the disease. So new applications of bone marrow cord blood transplantation are being discovered all the time. And this is overwhelmingly the most important type of stem cell therapy that's running today. Now, slightly less nice type of headline is this, which I also feel I should say something about. If you just dial stem cells into Google, you will get loads and loads of clinics popping up advertising miracle cures. And typically they will say, we have cells, you know, we have stem cells. They don't tell you very much about them. They may say they may come from the bone marrow, they may come from fat, they may come from just about anywhere. And they offer to inject them into any part of your body that hurts and cure you. And often there are very convincing testimonials from grateful patients who have been cured, which you can read about. But it's difficult to generalize, but mostly there is little rationale for these treatments, and mostly it's not known whether they're effective or not. It's possible they might be effective, but they're probably not effective. And just having somebody who goes somewhere, gets a treatment, and comes back and says they feel better, that's not evidence of effectiveness. Because most of the types of diseases and conditions for which this sort of therapy is offered are very variable in their course. Some people will get better anyway, or, you know, will have periods of remission or periods of improvement. Other people will get worse. If you happen to have your so-called stem cell therapy when you're just about to have a remission, you may think it's due to the therapy. But you can't prove it's due to the therapy unless you do a properly controlled clinical trial. And these places never do properly controlled clinical trials. So this is just a warning. And I really do recommend, I think the International Society for Stem Cell Research has done a terrific job on this really, very difficult issue. And if you're interested in, if any of you are contemplating stem cell therapy of this type, not regular bone marrow transplantation, but less well-defined type of stem cell therapy, I really do advise, go to this website or just dial International Society for Stem Cell Research into Google and you'll get there quickly enough, and look at their public section. And it's got really very good resources explaining the nature of some of these treatments, what sort of questions you ought to ask clinics, whether clinics are involved in real clinical trials or not, and a very nice patient handbook you can download. So I think they're doing a great job. Okay, let's move on then. And there are a few other niche types of adult stem cell therapy, which I don't have time to go into, but there are some genuine therapies to do with the skin for treatment of burns and of the eye for particularly treatment of chemical burns that destroy the front of the eye. But you can ask me about those, but I don't really have time to talk about them because I really want to spend a bit of time on embryonic stem cells. And well, here are these green cells again, and two presidents whose names have been associated with embryonic stem cells. And actually, I think I did have a slide, but in the interest of time, I left it out, dealing with the various presidential edicts and legal judgments. But let's leave those for the discussion. Let's just say that if you're in favor of embryonic stem cell research, President Bush wasn't all bad because his policy actually did allow research to continue. President Obama's not all good because his executive order, it did increase the number of cell lines that can be federally funded, but it hasn't really changed the playing field at all, hasn't really changed any of the regulations, and hasn't enabled people to make new embryonic stem cells with federal funding. So there's much more difference of perception between the two presidents' regimes than of reality. But I'm happy to pursue that further in the question session. So, human life, very important. But what is human life? You know, everybody thinks they know what human life is, but once you start thinking about it, it gets a bit more complicated. And this is the reason it's complicated. Now, this lady has become very famous. Actually, she's become more famous in recent years than she was, certainly when she was alive, or even in the 1950s when the science really got going. But Henrietta Lacks was a victim of a cervical carcinoma, a very aggressive cervical carcinoma, and she went for treatment to Johns Hopkins Medical School. And she was treated, but treatment wasn't very good in 1951, and she died. And it just so happened that one of the doctors dealing with the case was George Guy, and he was one of the pioneers of tissue culture, that is, growing cells in bottles with artificial media. And up till then, nobody had been able to culture human cells long-term. You know, you put them into culture and they'd grow for a bit and then they would die. And he took a sample of Henrietta's carcinoma and it grew like anything. It just kept growing and growing. And the cells became known as HeLa cells after the initials of her name. And they rapidly spread through laboratories all around the world because they were a very convenient source of human cells for doing all kinds of research. You know, anything from basic biochemistry, cell biology. You name it, people used HeLa cells to study it. And, well, I think even now, 60 years later, I think there's now a little more consciousness of perhaps that some more care should have been taken in taking these cells. Maybe Henrietta should have been asked if she wanted them taken, and maybe she should have had a consent form. Maybe it should have been explained to her a bit more what the cells were going to be used for, because they didn't do any of those sorts of things in 1951. Now we would do them. But I don't think anybody has ever claimed that HeLa cells deserve human rights, because everybody can see that they're just cells growing in a bottle. They're human. undeniably human, they're genetically human, they're alive, no doubt about that, they've grown to many tons of weight now, there are much more HeLa cells around than there ever was of Henrietta herself when she was alive. So they're certainly alive, but they're not human life in the sense that we understand it, expecting or appropriate to receive legal and ethical rights. And, of course, the issue is, are human embryos really like people, or are they like HeLa cells? That really is what the whole thing boils down to. And it's maybe helpful to look at some human embryos. So this is what they look like. They look pretty much the same as any other mammalian embryo. So there's a fertilized egg, 2-cell, 4-cell, 8-cell stage, forms a sort of smooth blob. You can't see the cells anymore, but they're still there. And then you get this blastocyst stage, which I mentioned earlier, and the little group of cells here called the inner cell mass are the ones that are taken out and used to set up embryonic stem cell lines. And so here's the issue. Is this early human embryo more like the tissue culture cell or more like the baby? Well, you know, scientists like me, of course, think it is more like the tissue culture cell. And that's why we've never had any moral qualms about research on human embryonic stem cells. But not everybody thinks that way. And again, I've taken out some of these slides. And it really does boil down to whether, some people have dug in on this idea that you have to draw the line somewhere. And I do sympathize with this because some people say, well, okay, they're not really quite the same as people, but you've got to draw the line somewhere because if you are willing to put these cells into a culture dish and grow them, you might want to do it with older embryos and newborn children or something dreadful like that. You wouldn't want that, would you? You have to draw the line somewhere. The only place you can really draw it is fertilization because that's a defined qualitative event. And, of course, some people take that view. I think probably the majority of people don't take that view. I think probably the majority feel or recognize that the qualities we associate with humanity develop gradually during embryonic development. Certainly the important biological things, you know, the individuality associated with the immune system or the individuality associated with your brain, certainly those things develop gradually and on the whole in the later part of fetal development rather than the earlier part. And so I think it's fair to say most people feel that the early stages are more like tissue culture cells, but, you know, one should be careful. And the later stages are more like human beings, and you should certainly not do scientific experiments with them. Exactly where you draw the line is a matter of debate, but there are one or two biological guides. I think you can never really persuade people because they will dig in on their ethical or religious beliefs that they happen to have. Nonetheless, I think there are one or two scientific facts that are useful when thinking about this. And one of them is the fact that actually, as far as we can tell from studying animal development, not a single one of the cells in that blastocyst stage, the stage at which the embryonic stem cell cultures are made, not a single one of those cells is exclusively going to be part of the embryo. All of the cells are going to contribute some of their offspring, some of their daughters, to the placenta. And, of course, the placenta is another one of these things like blood banks, HeLa cells, and so on, that's alive and human, but not really human life. And the other consideration, which has actually been incorporated into law in my country of origin, the United Kingdom, notes the fact that human twinning is possible up to about 14 days of development. So if you split the embryo mechanically into two groups of cells, you can get two complete individuals until about 14 days, which is the developmental stage at which it's not, you know, the body parts are beginning to be formed and you can no longer get twinning. And this is naturally occurring twinning. And so for that reason, the UK legislation has said that it's okay to do experiments on pre-implantation, early stage human embryos under license up until the 14-day stage, but not subsequently. Now, of course, in the US, there are no laws about any of this. There are no laws regulating experimentation with embryos or making embryonic stem cells or, in fact, doing all sorts of gruesome things. You could, in the United States, it is a free country. You are free. We are free, if we wished, to make human-animal hybrids, you know, to make human clones, do all sorts of dreadful things that nobody really approves of. There are no laws against this. But in most other countries, there are laws against it. In the US, the equivalent debate and the equivalent legal measures all relate to federal funding and not to whether things are allowed or not at all. And that's a very interesting cultural property of the USA, which people debate quite why it's like that, and I've heard various reasons. Anyway, so we can talk a bit more about that in the discussion. So what about embryonic stem cells? Are they actually going to generate any new cures? Because all the advocates of stem cell research, of course, have been promising cures for years. I must say, I think they've been slightly over-promising. I think they've been encouraging people to think that cures are very numerous and just around the corner, when in reality, I think they will come. I'm an optimist, but I think they'll take longer to come. I think there are more scientific, regulatory, and practical problems than people often represent. However, the first clinical trial of cells derived from human embryonic stem cells has actually started, and it's being carried out in California by the Geron Company. And the cells in question are, again, it's not really one of the headline-type things, this, but this is an oligodendrocyte. It's one of the cells in your central nervous system which wraps up nerve fibers in the insulating layer called myelin. And this company are able to make large numbers of reasonably pure oligodendrocytes from human embryonic stem cells. And they are currently, I don't know how many patients they've injected them into so far, but the trial is currently running, a very small phase one trial. That's a safety trial with a small number of people to see whether these things can be injected into damaged spinal cords in a safe manner. And the rationale for this is that if you have, well, unless the spinal cord is completely severed, if there are some surviving fibers passing an area of damage, then very often those fibers lose their myelin sheaths. So the fibers are still there, but they can't conduct impulses anymore. And the idea is if you put some of these cells in into the region of damage, then maybe those fibers that are still there can be remyelinated and will start to become functional again. So anyway, that's going. Everybody's expecting trials to start reasonably soon for, not very well, or not one of the things that's normally appearing in the headlines, but age-related macular degeneration of the eye, which is a condition, actually quite a common condition of older people, where the sort of middle part of your retina starts to deteriorate and lose function. And because of various other types of transplant work done in the past, it's believed that this could be fixed to a large extent, not by replacing the photoreceptors themselves, but by replacing the pigmented retina layer that lies outside them in the structure of the eye, because it's that pigmented retina that normally removes all the debris whose accumulation causes the macular degeneration. And it's relatively easy to make these pigmented retina cells from embryonic stem cells. And there's other various sort of practical advantages to therapy of the eye, which means that everybody is expecting a trial to start the next year or so on this. And then diabetes is probably the next one, maybe 2 to 3 years, it's hoped by the more optimistic folk involved in that. Not sure about heart muscle cells, I must say, because there's a lot of stem cell therapy of the heart going on at the moment, but using non-heart cells and where the effects are not heart muscle replacement, but more indirect effects of unknown nature. Okay, let's say a little word about diabetes, because this is one of my own research interests. So, again, I guess everybody's heard of diabetes, and a lot of people know quite a lot about it. A lot of people suffer from it. In general, diabetes means your blood sugar is not under control, usually going too high. The minority of diabetics, people with type 1 diabetes, have lost the beta cells that normally secrete the hormone insulin, and they're unable to control blood sugar, and they have to take insulin every day. Without that, they would die. And the more numerous and usually older type 2 diabetics, it used to be said that these were people whose pancreas and beta cells were fine, but their tissues were the tissues on which insulin normally acts were resistant to insulin. There's some truth in that, but also in recent years it's been found that just about every type 2 diabetic patient also has some beta cell defect. So that the beta cells are not able to produce enough insulin or not able to adapt to changing metabolism sufficiently to produce enough insulin. And that there's always some genetic or infectious or environmental or congenital defect in beta cells for type 2 diabetics as well. And of course, a lot of type 2 diabetics do take insulin. So insulin was discovered in 1921, and it's, you know, always going to be one of medicine's greatest discoveries. And it meant that the type 1 diabetics could actually live instead of die. It was as stark and dramatic as that. And insulin therapy is used today on a very wide scale. And I think because it's been so successful, people think that a lot of people think that diabetes has been fixed. It's not really a big medical problem anymore. But actually, it's a terrific medical problem. And it's a problem because unless the blood sugar levels are absolutely perfectly controlled, the excursions of blood sugar gradually cause damage to blood vessels all over the body. And this damage to blood vessels is cumulative and progressive, and eventually it will cause real problems like heart failure, stroke, blindness, kidney failure, and all sorts of disorders like inability to heal wounds, sort of development of peripheral gangrene, and necessitating amputations. So all sorts of really very unpleasant complications can develop from diabetes. And it's because of this that diabetes is actually, you know, quite apart from the human suffering involved, which is very considerable, there's also a very big economic issue. Because all advanced country health systems, and everybody knows how expensive healthcare is, well, something between 10 and 15%, and some people say it's even more than that, of, you know, big country, big health budgets are spent on diabetes care. So it's a huge economic issue as well as a human suffering issue. And in order to prevent complications, you've really got to get your blood sugar control absolutely right. And you're never going to be able to do that by a small number of insulin injections each day. And about 10 years ago now, this technique came along. And there was a lot of optimism about it. That optimism has reduced, although I think unreasonably. I think actually this technique's been a terrific success because it's a really successful example of cell therapy. And this is the pancreatic islet transplant. And what you do is you take a donor pancreas from a human organ donor, you know, road accident victim or something, who's donated his organs for treating others. You treat them with an enzyme to release these pancreatic islets, which is where the beta cells live, and then the islets are infused, and they're normally put into the portal vein so that they lodge in the venous spaces in the liver. And because the blood supply to the liver is sufficiently similar to the pancreas that they can work quite well there. And these transplants, they're not 100% successful, but I'm told that almost everybody who gets them at least improves, and the worst consequences of sort of uncontrolled unawareness of low blood sugar can be corrected. And some people are able to come off insulin altogether, maybe for quite prolonged periods, like a year or two. But usually the grafts are not completely successful and don't last forever. Nonetheless, they clearly work. You can show by any number of biochemical measurements that they're working, and they always seem to at least improve the condition. But there are two big problems with this technique. One is the familiar problem of the organ donors, that of course for all types of transplantation there are never enough donors. And the second problem is that these are what we call allografts. These are grafts from one individual to another, and that always means graft rejection, and therefore the recipients have to have immunosuppressive drug treatment for the rest of their lives, otherwise the graft will be rejected. And there are always complications associated with that. Now, the University of Minnesota is not only was a pioneer in bone marrow transplantation, it's also been a leader in islet transplantation in recent years. Particularly the group around Dr. Bernard Herring in the Department of Surgery has got very good results indeed with this technique. And was it 2 years ago, nearly 2 years ago now, Bernard Herring and some collaborators, including our own Mary Firpo from the Stem Cell Institute, received this enormous donation from the Schultz Family Foundation to develop a new source of beta cells for islet transplantation. And this money is divided. Some of it is actually going to Bernard Herring, who believes very passionately that islets from pigs can be made acceptable for human grafting. And a rather smaller quantity of the money has gone to Dr. Firpo to see if she can make insulin-producing beta cells from induced pluripotent stem cells. Induced pluripotent stem cells. He hasn't mentioned them yet. What are they? Well, induced pluripotent stem cells are the same as embryonic stem cells, except they're not from embryos. And in fact, the Schultz family do not approve of work with human embryonic stem cells, so they didn't want to fund a project. I mean, they understand that the Stem Cell Institute works with them, and they're okay with that, but they didn't themselves want to fund a project based on using human embryonic stem cells. But very fortunately, history has come to the point where that may not be too much of a handicap. So, in fact, the last few minutes I want to tell you about induced pluripotent stem cells, because this is really where the future lies, and these are very important indeed. So as I just said, they are the same as embryonic stem cells, and these are colonies of what we call iPS cells. You see, each blob is a colony of cells, maybe 50 or 100 cells in the blob, surrounded by these feeder cells. And they're made from, usually from what we call fibroblasts, which are the cells in the lower layer of the skin, which can be removed with a small skin biopsy and grown in culture. And this is what fibroblasts look like. And this guy, Shinya Yamanaka in Kyoto in Japan, about four years ago now, discovered the technique, which is essentially to take four genes which are known to be important for maintaining the properties of embryonic stem cells and to put those genes into ordinary fibroblasts, and then about one cell in 1,000 or one in 10,000 becomes transformed into a behavior which is exactly the same as the embryonic stem cell. And with appropriate techniques, you can select those out and isolate them and grow them. And I would really like to stress very strongly that unless people had worked with embryonic stem cells, both animal and human, for some years prior to this discovery, the discovery would never have been made, because all of this rested on the knowledge of the properties of embryonic stem cells and knowledge and the technology of growing them and working with them. iPS cells have the same properties as embryonic stem cells. So they can be caused to differentiate into various cell types, like here. And this is some we made ourselves about a year ago, which, as you see, I wouldn't like to say every cell in the dish is a heart muscle cell, but they're certainly, some of them are heart muscle cells. iPS cells are important for all these reasons. They are relatively easy to make. So lots of labs around the world have made them, both from animals and human cells. You don't need any embryos or eggs to make them, and that's a big relief as far as the ethical debate is concerned. And it's also a practical issue, because actually working with embryos is quite difficult, and you need lots of special expertise and equipment. And you know, if you want human embryos, very, very invasive, any woman who's been through in vitro fertilization knows just how difficult the oocyte donation process is. So lots of practical as well as ethical reasons why avoiding working with human embryos is an advantage, and that they can be made from individual patients. So any of us could give a small skin punch, just a few millimeters, or maybe a blood sample to produce some white blood cells, because you can also make iPS cells from them, and generate your own tailor-made embryonic stem cell line, iPS cell line, which is exactly the same genetics as you yourself. So you can receive a graft made from these cells with absolutely no immunological problems. Now, it's not quite as good as that. Nothing is ever quite as good as that. And so the problems, at the moment, the technique does depend on putting these genes into the cells. Now, some of the genes are genes associated with development of cancer. And if you put these genes in, obviously that is potentially risky. You might generate a line of cancer cells instead of a line of heart muscle cells, and then when you inject them back into yourself, you've got cancer. So that's something you don't want. Even if you avoid using those genes associated with cancer development, just putting any gene into a cell involves some risk. And this has been discovered by people doing gene therapy, that the viral vectors that are used to introduce genes into cells do have a preference for inserting new genes into the site where existing genes are living in your DNA. And that means they may destroy the gene that goes in on top of, or they might hyperactivate it, or they might, you know, they might mess up its regulation in some way. And so gene integration in general is thought to be a bad thing. So current research with iPS cells is really based on finding ways of doing this that don't involve gene integration. And this is probably possible. You can do it with RNA, which is the intermediate step between the gene and the protein. You may even be able to do it with proteins, although you've got to get them into the cell in a more efficient way than proteins normally enter cells. But there are many labs working on this. There are several methods that look reasonably promising, and I'm quite sure that in another 2 or 3 years, all iPS cells will be being made without integrating viral vectors. Okay, that's just about it. I've gone on a bit longer than I really intended, but I haven't really given you any scientific details at all, and you're very welcome to ask about them. But I've just illustrated 2 or 3 important points. And just to finish up with, so these are the questions people usually start by asking. So when are we going to get the new treatments? Don't forget that the hematopoietic cell grafts have been running for about 30 years and have saved many thousands of lives already. The more niche types of adult stem cell therapy to do with the skin and the eye have probably saved, you know, a couple of hundred people's lives. Trouble with professors is they're completely useless without their slides. They're like, like babies. Okay, so when will embryonic stem cells or indeed iPS cells deliver new treatments? And although I think people have overpromised, but I think we will get there. There are, you know, big scientific and technical problems. There are very big safety and regulatory problems Because, for example, you've got to guarantee if you make your dish of heart muscle cells to fix some heart attack, how do you know that there isn't one cell in 10,000 left in the dish, which is still the original pluripotent embryonic stem cell? Because that cell can develop into a tumor called a teratoma. If you just graft embryonic stem cells into an animal, you get these tumors formed. You don't want that to happen. So there are a number of safety issues of that sort. There's the whole issue of, is personalized cell culture really going to work? I've just told you that you can make iPS cells from anybody in this room and you could use those for your own therapy. That's true in principle, but people say, oh, it's all going to be too expensive. It's never going to happen. Very costly, very time-consuming. So I think the issue of whether the problem of immune rejection is going to be fixed by personalized cell culture or by some other method, I think that has yet to be resolved. But nonetheless, I think embryonic stem cells and iPS cells are very important technology and they are certain to deliver something over the next few years. And then what about the future? Well, I can remember two medical innovations when they were headlines. One was the heart transplant and the other was IVF. And I remember that in both cases, there was this worldwide sort of horror. And with the heart transplant, everybody was saying, oh, that's just too awful. I couldn't imagine having somebody else's heart in me. No way. Now, everybody's queuing up for heart transplants. And with IVF, and this is really true, that people were writing in the papers, academic psychologists were writing seriously in the papers and saying, this technique is a complete abomination. It must never be permitted. And the reason is because the psychological stress on the children of knowing that they had been conceived in a test tube, this would be insupportable. They couldn't possibly live, they would certainly die of the psychological trauma. And of course, this is complete nonsense, and now, 3-4 million babies have been born by IVF around the world, and it's completely routine now, and nobody thinks anything of it. And, I think that process will happen again, and that things people think are very odd, or rather peculiar, or they don't like the idea of them very much, I think in 30, 50 years' time, they'll just be completely routine. So on that note, I will finish and open up discussion.
Wow, that was fascinating. We have some new cocktail party conversation now. We're all ready, ready for the party. Front row, here we go.
In one of your original slides, you showed how the sides, the cells, split and split and split. And in some of your later slides, you had showed a number of cells. How do you differentiate with those cells? Which ones are going to do this helpfully and others are going to run away and not be able to stop?
Well, if it's embryonic stem cells, there are different culture conditions. So there's one set of culture conditions for expanding them and getting them to keep on growing but staying in a pluripotent state. And then when you want to differentiate them, you put them in different culture conditions. And like I said, you'd normally have to take them through a series of different steps, maybe, 4 days in this medium and 5 days in the next medium and so on. And hopefully, the cells, ideally they'll all behave in the same way and all respond in the same way. And so in the first case, 100% of the cells in the dish will be expanding and undifferentiated, and in the second case, 100% will be doing what you want. In reality, they don't all behave in the same way, and that's what generates these potential safety problems, because you might have one or two pluripotent cells still left in your differentiated population.
Wow. I have a friend here.
Hi, I have a son who has a chromosomal deletion, and he has cortical dysplasia, and he has epilepsy. And I have a friend in Australia who has a son with the exact same genetic deletion. She went to this place in the Dominican Republic where supposedly they injected fetal stem cells into her son, in his legs, and through an IV drip. And she says she's seeing all these remarkable changes in him, that he's making all this progress. Is there any way that you could inject fetal stem cells and they would find the places in the brain? I mean, is there any way it's not a scam?
Well, I think it's almost certain that all of the donor cells would die within a couple of weeks of a graft. So it's exceedingly unlikely. I mean, with animal experiments where you can guarantee immunological compatibility, then yes, I mean, there are some that, you know, you can take, what are called stem cells? So they're really neuronal progenitor cells from the fetus, and they can be grafted into the brain. They will form neurons, and they will form connections with the host. So to that extent, it's possible. But I think a human graft from an unrelated donor, you can absolutely guarantee that all the cells will be dead within a couple of weeks. So I think it's the changes are certainly not due to any repopulation of the brain by the graft cells. For cell therapy of this type, where all the cells die very quickly, people sometimes say, well, there may be indirect effects. There may be effects on the immune system of the host. There may be effects on the blood supply of the region that was injected. There may be indirect effects of this sort, or the cells might release substances as they're dying, which provoke host cells to multiply or generate new blood vessels or do something beneficial. And, you know, there are lots of people investigating those types of effect, and they may be real. But I think I can absolutely guarantee that there would be no repopulation of the brain with new neurons from a graft like that.
Amazing, isn't it? Question over here, sorry. I may need a new foot before we're done.
Could you please expand a bit for somebody with very little scientific knowledge on the use of viruses as a medium for treatment?
Okay, sure, yes. Viruses are, you know, naturally occurring microorganism or type of microorganism which cannot reproduce on their own, and they can only reproduce if they get their genes into one of your cells and make use of your biochemical machinery for making their, you know, replicating their own genes and making their own proteins. Some viruses have been very, well, you know, again, people have studied viruses of all sorts for many decades, and a huge amount is known about them. And a small number of viruses have been, as it were, domesticated for laboratory use. And, there are several different kinds, and they belong to various different, you know, virus types. But in general, what you do is you take away most of the viral genes themselves. You just keep the essential bits that are needed for infecting cells. And you take away all of the pathogenic parts of the virus. And then you put the genes you want to introduce into the gap. And then because you've taken away all the things that the virus needs to replicate, you need some special cells which contain the missing viral genes. And you grow your virus up in those cells. So you can generate some virus particles which can carry genes, can infect cells, but can't themselves replicate or generate any new virus particles. That's what we call a viral vector. And those are used in a huge scale in laboratories for all sorts of experiments where you want to get genes into cells or indeed intact animals, because you know, you can give these viral vectors to animals or indeed even people in gene therapy applications. So, being a professor, I've got to, as well as the fun of doing or supervising experiments, I've also got to deal with a whole load of regulatory stuff at the university, which I must say is very time-consuming. And one of the sorts of regulation we have to deal with is biosafety. And I've learned always to say viral vector instead of virus, because virus just sounds bad. It just sounds as though this is something that's going to be hazardous. And viral vector sounds a bit more cryptic.
I thought troubled waters caused us a problem, huh?
So, that's what they are. They're not really viruses. They're viral vectors, but they are made from viruses.
Terrific. We have a question over here on the far right.
So I guess I wanted to know, relating to what the first question was, what's the what would be the difference between injecting embryonic stem cells into a certain tissue, into a certain area, and culturing iPS cells with a given set of genes? And I guess more basically, what genes are used to change a fibroblast into an iPS cell?
You really want to know? Well,
could you help us understand this question a little bit as you answer, please?
Well, he said, what genes should I use to make some iPS cells? He said, the most important one's a gene called OCT4, which is encodes a transcription factor. And transcription factors are proteins that regulate gene expression. And OCT4 is very critical. It's in the central network of genes that control growth and pluripotent behavior of embryonic stem cells. And then another one's called SOX2, which is also encodes a transcription factor with different but comparable functions to OCT4. And then there's a bit more. You can use really two or three out of a set of maybe another dozen or so genes, and people debate about quite what they're doing, but I think what they're doing is actually opening up the chromosomes and allowing the OCT4 and the SOX2 to find their targets. They've each got hundreds of target sites, many hundreds of genes that they regulate in the DNA. And if you open up the DNA to some extent, I think it just makes it easier for them to find them. And it means that, you know, 1 in 1,000 cells will become an iPS cell instead of 1 in 1,000,000. So does that answer the question? I don't think I really answered the first half of your question, but maybe you could put that again.
I wanted to ask, is there any tissue type where you could inject an embryonic cell and have it develop into whatever mature cell type is in the area?
Probably not, because the embryonic development proceeds through a hierarchy of decisions. So you don't go directly from an embryonic stem cell to a muscle cell or a neuron. You go through a series of, you know, 5 or 6 intermediate steps, which are, and as I said, the steps that you lead them through in culture would be, on the whole, mimicking what happens in normal development. So if you just inject embryonic stem cells into an animal, you get this, they don't differentiate. They make a type of tumor called teratoma. They're called teratomas because they closely resemble naturally occurring tumors that we get, usually derived from germ cells, which have all sorts of different tissue types in them. And they also have regions of undifferentiated embryonic stem-like cells in them. So, in other words, they will they generate one of these tumors. Some of the cells in the tumor are embryonic stem cells that keep growing, and others are a sort of chaotic mass of all sorts of different tissue types. So that's what you get if you just inject pluripotent cells, either embryonic stem cells or iPS cells. They're the same. If you inject them into any part of your body, they'll form a teratoma, and you don't want that. So in order to get them to differentiate, you've got to recapitulate or mimic the normal process of embryonic development.
We have a question in the back here.
I actually have two questions. One is a follow-up for that, and I was going to ask a similar question. I assume that then you actually go through a differentiation to, let's say, make a neural stem cell before you inject it into the neural tissue, rather than have it differentiate because of the environment into which you've put it. And the second question I have is, I assume that every one of these embryonic stem cells or lines that you get have their own tissue antigens, and you're going to inject this into someone from whom it may not have been derived. Does that mean we have to have thousands of lines that would be immunologically compatible with the individual that's going to be the recipient, or can you in some way modify those antigens to go into anyone?
The answer to the second question is absolutely yes. You're quite right. You know, it's an allograft. It's just like grafting from one individual to another, and all the same issues of rejection and immune suppression arise. However, because embryonic stem cells or iPS cells are, relatively easy to grow in large quantities. You can either take the route of the personalized cell line, which is a perfect genetic match, but you've got to grow the cell line from you for your therapy, and that may take many months, and you know, you might die of your disease while that's happening, or you might not be able to afford to pay for the enormous costs. The majority of people at the moment, I'm personally a believer in personalized cell culture. I think it's going to happen. And the reason I think it's going to happen is I know it's really expensive now, but, you know, look at this thing on the bench in front of me. Mm-hmm. It's cost a few hundred dollars. I mean, one of them would have cost you, you know, many, many millions of dollars 20 or 30 years ago. So things do get a lot cheaper as technology develops. So I actually think personalized cell culture will come. But I would say the majority view among scientists is that it's not practical, and there will need to be stem cell banks established. And they have tried to do calculations about how many cell lines you need in order to get a reasonably good genetic match for any patient. And if you're living in Japan, the answer is about 70. So it's not very many. But Japan has genetically a very homogeneous population, especially compared to the USA. USA is obviously one of the most diverse countries in the world in terms of genetics. However, you know, people usually reckon a few hundred, maybe 200, 300 ES cell lines, iPS cell lines in a bank. That would give you a close enough match that the rejection problems would be very minor. So that's... it's a fairly formidable task to have a stem cell bank of that size, but it's by no means impossible. Now, the first question, on the whole, the people think in terms really of grafting fully differentiated cells. That's really the objective. Although it may be that won't be practical. For example, with the pancreatic beta cells, I know that the leading groups making beta cells from human ES cells, actually they can't get fully mature glucose-sensitive beta cells in culture. The only way they can get fully functional beta cells is to make progenitor cells in culture, say the first three or four steps of development, and then graft those into their experimental animals and wait for maybe 2-3 months for the final maturation to take place. That might be the route that's followed. It may be that you don't need absolutely the final functional cell. The precursor population will do. But, you know, the more I think it is very difficult to imagine more than one step of maturation post-graft, because I think if you go back further than that, you're really in teratoma country, and it would not be wise.
Could you do nuclear transfer and create embryonic stem cells from that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
an
interesting
use that for,
point, yes.
In diabetes where you have time.
Well, you see, now I haven't said anything about somatic nuclear transfer, but the reason I've not said anything about it is I wanted to tell you about iPS cells, because iPS cells are a really, as I say, it's a fully viable technology that many, many labs are using around the world. Now, if I'd been giving this talk 5 years ago, I would probably have devoted quite a lot of time talking about somatic nuclear transfer. So what is that? It's a method of making a personalized embryonic stem cell line, and it works in animals, although it's never actually been done in humans. And what you do is you get an oocyte, that is the egg which is released from the female at ovulation but has not yet fully matured. You take the oocyte, you remove its nucleus, and you put in the nucleus from a donor cell. It can be any cell. And in about one case in 200-300, the donor nucleus becomes reprogrammed, and it will swell up, and the genes that were on get turned off. The genes that are normally on in a fertilized egg become turned on, And if you're very lucky, it will support embryonic development and the cells start dividing and start developing as usual. So these experiments have been done in, well, they were first done in frogs, my favorite experimental organism, and then people went on to mice and cattle. They work reasonably well in cows, actually. But it's a very inefficient process, and you need hundreds of oocytes in order to get one surviving embryo to term. You can either reimplant your embryo and grow it to term, and that's a clone, so you wouldn't want to do that with human beings, or you can take the embryo that's been arisen from the first few divisions of the reconstituted egg and use that to set up a line of embryonic stem cells. And that's sometimes called therapeutic cloning, and certain people who are against cloning think it's okay because it's just growing cells, and some people who are against it think it's very wicked because it's called cloning. There's been endless ethical debate about it, but actually, for all the debate, nobody has ever done it with human cells successfully. There was a Korean scientist called Woo Hwang-suk who claimed to have done it, I think, about 5 years ago, but it turned out it was a fraudulent claim, and he never did actually do it. So I think labs that have been interested in this technology have really run up against the problems, the practical and ethical problems of obtaining lots and lots of human oocytes, because you need lots of willing female volunteers to go through a rather unpleasant process of egg donation for no money, because you're not allowed to pay people for this type of service. So you don't get any donors, and the labs that have been interested in this have not done anything. And I think with the discovery of iPS cells, people have just given up on this. It's just regarded as too difficult, but both from a practical and ethical point of view. And you can achieve the same result with iPS cells very easily.
We have a question over on the right, Marty.
I have a question with regard to cancer development. In the case where the human body is assaulted by, let's say, environmental issues or environmental insults, which cells are more likely to be mutated? Is there any evidence that the stem cells, let's say a lung stem cell, is more likely to be mutated versus a mature lung cell? Are the stem cells more subject to mutation? They're in the human body, and they're ready to become a mature cell. So it's just a question, because I've read a little bit that suggests that adult stem cells are more directly related to cancer development than we thought before.
I think that's a really hard question to answer. And if you just think about the intestine, you can see why it's so difficult to answer. I showed a slide of the intestine earlier on, and the small intestine and the large intestine are sort of fairly similar. They've both got these crypts with stem cells in them. The lining of both parts of the intestine turn over very quickly. The only difference is the large intestine doesn't have those absorptive villi in it. Now, cancer of the colon is very common. You know, lots of people get cancer of the colon, and we all have these colonoscopies to spot polyps, and loads of people are getting polyps all the time. Small intestinal cancer is almost unheard of, and yet the cells are dividing perhaps slightly faster, and there's certainly more of them. The small intestine is much longer than the large intestine, so the number of target cells is actually bigger. So I think if you didn't know anything about human disease and you were just told about the cell turnover in different parts of the bodies and asked which bit of the body would get most cancer, you'd say the small intestine for sure, and actually it almost never gets cancer. Large intestine quite frequently does. So I think it's really, and again, if you look at the skin, now skin cancers are actually quite common, and that's not surprising because, again, the skin's got very active stem cells in it. Everyone knows the skin's being renewed all the time. And everybody's heard of malignant melanomas that are not, fortunately, not very common. But actually the common skin cancers, the squamous and basal cell carcinomas, a lot of people are getting them all the time, particularly people who work outdoors and exposed to a lot of sunlight. But they're not very dangerous. As long as they're removed early, they very rarely kill anybody. And they're often not included in cancer registries, so they often get missed out of the figures. So skin cancers are often thought to be not very common because people focus on melanomas. But from a cell biology point of view, actually these much less serious diseases are much more common. So really hard to answer, I think. Although cells that never divide in the body, you know, like mature neurons, really they don't get cancer. So, you know, tumours in your brain are much more likely to be from the glial cells, the cells surrounding the neurons that do sometimes divide. Also, you know, muscle. You do get tumours of muscle and nerve, but they're mostly in children where you still have precursor cells growing. So completely non-dividing tissues are very unlikely to get cancer, but I think beyond that, it's very hard to generalise.
I'm curious about the mouse heart muscle that you synthesized. Did it begin to beat on its own, or did it require stimulation to do that?
Well, that beat on its own, and actually it's a property of heart muscle cells that they do beat spontaneously. So it's, although it looks good in a movie, and people always love to show movies like that if they've got them, actually they're not difficult to, you know, if you get any heart muscle cells, then you'll get a beating structure of some sort. I mean, in your actual heart, while it's actually working, the frequency of the beating is controlled by pacemaker, and that's controlled by, you know, hormones and neuronal inputs and so on. So if you took your heart muscle cells out and put them in culture, they'd still beat, but they'd beat more slowly than they do in your functioning heart.
Can you compare stem cell politics in England to the United States stem cell politics?
Oh, well, that's a very interesting question. I'll probably talk for hours about that. I think the biggest difference is this thing I briefly mentioned, that in the US, the debate's all about federal funding. It's not about the what's allowed and not allowed. It's about what the federal government should be permitted to fund. And whereas in Britain, in fact, in most other countries, if something is thought to be bad, you know, if you believe that human cloning, I mean, actually most people, I believe human cloning is bad. I think it would be a very unwise thing to try and do for all sorts of reasons. Most countries where the legislature thinks human cloning is bad will just pass a law against it. So most countries actually have laws prohibiting human cloning, not the USA. If you want to clone yourself or me, you're perfectly free to do it, but you've got to do it with your own money. You mustn't use any federal money or any suspicion of any federal money, or indeed state money, which often sort of comes along with federal money. I mean, the other big difference, of course, is Britain is one of the places that's seen as being very permissive for embryonic stem cell research. And I think it's probably true. You know, Britain is a less religious country than the USA. There are more people of the types of religious group who are against working with human embryos in the USA. I believe that polls show that, you know, actually about 80% of people in the USA do support human embryonic stem cell research. But nonetheless, that 20% is quite a big voting block and a lot bigger than it would be in Britain. Also, I think British politicians rather unwisely, I think, believed that they could steal a march on the USA, and by having a very liberal legislation, which incidentally doesn't just permit working with, I mean, here we can work with human ES cell lines so long as they've been isolated under, you know, with proper documentation of the donation by the original parents. And I should say, by the way, all of the embryos used for this purpose are frozen embryos from IVF clinics that would otherwise be discarded. But you do need documentation of informed consent for this particular research purpose from the original parents. So you are allowed to do that in the US with federal funding at the moment. But in Britain, you're also allowed to make new embryonic stem cell lines from embryos under license, and you're allowed to do other things. You're allowed to do somatic nuclear cloning, although nobody's done it. You're allowed to make transplants of embryo nuclei into animal eggs or somatic nuclei into animal eggs, although that doesn't actually work. So the regime is much more liberal, although it's all licensed. There's lots of bureaucracy associated with it, and you have to have a license to do any of these things. The sad fact is that, you know, the truth is the USA is still the leader in stem cell research. Just the size, scale, whatever the debates and restrictions in the US, actually the US is just bigger than Britain, and I don't think anybody in Britain really made a... there's some great people there, some terrific scientists, but in terms of human embryonic stem cell research and applications, I don't think Britain has done very much, hasn't been done anywhere else. So in that sense, the legislative issues have made less difference than people often like to say they make. At the same time, I should say, you know, we were introduced originally by a reference to this injunction that was recently came out. Now, this injunction actually was a very serious matter because its effect would be not just to return to the regime under President Bush, which allowed a certain range of human ESL lines to be used with federal funding. It actually would have prohibited all use of human ES cells with federal funding. And immediately you have the knock-on of that also means state funding, because in a place in our university, for example, really just to keep, although the university leaders are in favor of human ES cell work, they also want easy lives, and they like to stick to a rule that says you can use state money for the same things you can use federal money for, because then they don't have to have lots of extra rules. So it also means you lose all your state money. And there are... So had this injunction held, it would actually have terminated a lot of research around the country. Many, many NIH-funded projects would have stopped, and it would have been very disruptive. And you might say, well, you know, now you've got iPS cells, does it really matter so much anymore? But those iPS cells, you know, this is early days yet, and to be sure, everybody who works with iPS cells also needs to keep ES cells in the lab in order to serve as controls. You've got to make sure your iPS cells have got the right genes active. You've got to make sure they've got the right surface molecules on them. You've got to make sure they make the right sort of teratomas. And to do all these comparisons, you've got to have your embryonic stem cells growing alongside. So, ironically, had this injunction remained in force, the major casualty would have been a lot of iPS cell work, which is, you know, adult stem cell research. In other words, the sort of research that the opponents of stem cell research claim to favor. It's that would have suffered, because all the labs doing it also need to keep embryonic stem cells in order to do their iPS work. Now, that may not be the case forever. I mean, it won't be the case forever. You know, in 5-10 years' time, I think it's possible that maybe, except for one or two very specialized applications, we may not need human embryonic stem cells anymore. That's perfectly possible. But it's not the case at the moment. And there is still a danger that this injunction may come back. So if anybody's got any influence with your, particularly anybody in Congress, National Congress, please write to them and ask them to preferably repeal or at the very least clarify this thing called the Dickey Wicker Amendment, which is the amendment that's passed every year prohibiting any research, any federal funding on human embryo research, because that's the rationale for this injunction. So this will hang over us as this legal procedure carries on for the next year or two, I think, and there is a real risk that a very repressive regime could be reintroduced.
What was the name of that law or amendment?
The Dickey Wicker Amendment.
Well, we all have our homework. Yeah. Fascinating. I have a feeling you're in this for the long
time. Well, we're seeing Senator Franken's representative on Monday, so that's our main message to them.
Wonderful. You have time for just one last quick question.
And it'll be short when you answered most of my question. My last part is, where's the private sector in this? Because even if you do get the federal government to fund this, you're going to fight from New York to California with every institute to get what little bit of funding will be available. Where's your Microsofts and your Johnson & Johnsons and all these people? Are they that scared of embryonic stem cells? They don't want to invest in this?
Well, there are companies, and some of them are quite successful. So the front runners in the beta cell, you know, making beta cells from human ES cells is a company. But there isn't big money in it, and I think it's really because the investment climate isn't what it was in, you know, in the dot-com bubble. And in those days, venture capitalists would put loads of money into all sorts of crazy ideas. They did put money into biotech as well as technology companies in those days. The truth is that biotech's much slower, and they, you know, some biotech companies have prospered and made people a lot of money, but many have gone under, and many have just carried on at a modest level, or have been, you know, the usual outcome is they get bought up by bigger companies, and so the activity persists. But you know, it takes many years to develop one of these life science products to something that will actually make a lot of money. And I think for that reason, the investment at the moment is still relatively small. Although, you know, once you can make a lot of money in a five-year time horizon, guaranteed, then I'm sure the big bucks will come in.
How can we follow the work of you and your colleagues in the Stem Cell Institute? Website, or do you have accessible things on the website?
Well, we do have a website, and it doesn't give a sort of day-to-day account of what's going on, but it provides various background information and so forth, and lists of faculty. You could look at the faculty's web pages. I should say, you know, this is a university, and although I'm called the director, it's not like being a director of a company. I don't tell any of the faculty what to do. They're all independent. They've all got their own research programs, so my activities are more catalytic than directive. And that's often, you know, I guess a lot of people here are familiar with universities and understand that, but it can be very difficult to explain that to journalists sometimes, you know, because they think you're the boss and you're telling everybody what to do, and you can fire half the people and recruit another 100 people tomorrow and get them to do something different. Well, it's not like that in a university.
Well, we're not journalists, but we are really appreciative citizens of learning about this tonight. This has been totally fascinating, and thank you for your generous time, and keep up your good work.